only 8 additional columns. I photocopied all the pages on the off chance I'd need to look at them again. No point in being forced to make a return trip. I put that volume back and pulled the 1956 city directory, checking for the same 3 names, Erickson, Treadwell, and Hernandez. 2 of the 3 families were gone, which indicated death, divorce, or a simple move to another town. I noticed that after 1956, the county directory had been converted to a city directory that covered only Santa Maria and Lompoc, with no mention of Serena Station at all. I pulled the 1986 telephone book and searched again, hoping to find a trace. The Hernandez family was a wash. There being so many listed, I knew I'd never track down the one I wanted. I had slightly better luck with Erickson. I didn't find a J or a B, but there was an A. Erickson in Santa Maria, possibly John and Bernadette's offspring. A family named Treadwell was living in Orcutt, and though the husband's first name wasn't a match, I thought there might be a connection. I wrote down both sets of phone numbers and street addresses. At the desk, while I paid for my photocopies, I spoke to one of the librarians and explained what I needed. Where else can I get information about Serena Station in 1953? I've gone through the old directories. He said, "You might want to look at the index to precinct registers for Santa Teresa County. I believe we have 51 and 1954. Great. Or not great, as it happened. We returned to the shelves and he found me the requisite volume from 1951. Again I sat down and looked up the community of Serena Station. The listings included names, addresses, occupations, and party affiliation, more Republicans than Democrats for what that's worth. But all the addresses listed were post office boxes, which didn't do me any good. I flipped back to the pages devoted to Santa Maria, running a finger down page after page of residence. I gave up after 10 minutes because the numbers were overwhelming, and I was hoping I had already snagged what I needed. I gathered my notes and took the elevator to the ground floor in search of a payphone. I tried the Treadwell's number first and bombed out big time. The Mrs. Treadwell who answered had never lived in Serena Station, had never known the Sullivans, and couldn't be any help at all when it came to tracking down the former Serena Station Treadwells. She suspected I was trying to sell her something and declined any further questions. I tried A. Erickson and got a machine, on which I left the following message. "Hi, my name is Kinsey Milhone. I'm a private investigator from Santa Teresa, and I'm wondering if you're the same Erickson who lived in Serena Station in 1953. I'd appreciate a call back when you get this message." I recited my Santa Teresa phone number and repeated my name. Then I went out to my car and headed for the 101. I unlocked my apartment door at 5:15. I'd been away since Thursday morning, and the living room was stuffy, smelling of old cleaning products and hot dust motes. I put my portable typewriter on the desk. I had 2 messages from Cheney asking me to call him when I got home. I tried his number and got a busy signal. I didn't have a duffel, but my newly purchased clothing was folded and packed in a handsome plastic bag. I trotted up the spiral stairs and unloaded the bag. I fired up the kettle and made myself a cup of tea, which I sipped while I sat at the kitchen counter and sorted through my notes. I thought it was entirely possible that I'd already spoken to Violet's killer. The motive might have been anything—jealousy, hatred, greed, revenge—but I knew the killing itself was cold-blooded, because the hole had been dug well in advance of the burial. The killer couldn't have been sure the necessary equipment would be on the scene unless he'd set it up that way. When Violet disappeared, her money had disappeared as well. Ostensibly, she'd taken possession of the $50,000 in her safe deposit box. She'd also borrowed $2,000 from her brother and $500 from her mother, in addition to the jewelry she'd stolen. So where did all the money and the jewelry end up? It was always possible the stash would be found in the car, but if the killer knew she had it, why not help himself to the money before he bulldozed the dirt back into the hole? He had to be someone she knew, and probably a local, since he was sufficiently familiar with both the Tanner property and the building of New Cut Road to feel assured he'd have privacy. He must have had a cover story to account for the time he'd spent digging the hole. That meant he was either his own boss, in which case he could take all the time he needed, or if he was a 9-to-5 kind of guy, he was off on vacation or he'd called in sick. With the holiday weekend, he might have had the time off. Foley Sullivan was still at the top of my list. Granted, I'd found the man sympathetic, but he'd had years of practice declaring his innocence. I believed him when he spoke of his love for Violet, but that didn't mean he hadn't killed her. I went back to the notes I'd taken after talking to Chet Kramer. I couldn't see what he had to gain, but I didn't rule him out. He didn't strike me as a fellow with much experience operating heavy equipment, but I jotted down an offhand remark he'd made. He'd said you could always hire somebody to do your dirty work. I thought about Winston Smith, who'd been fired because of Violet. While Kramer had rehired him the following week, he hadn't known about that when she vanished. I was iffy about him. He was convinced she'd ruined his life, which, in some ways, she had. If he'd gotten the education he'd planned, he wouldn't be selling cars, and he might not be married to the woman who now proposed booting his butt out the door. I knew little about Tom Paget, but he was worth checking out. Steve Ottweiler? Nah. I put a tick by his name, but only in the interest of being fair. As long as I was suspicious of the other guys, I might as well include him. He'd been 16 at the time, and from Violet's point of view, he was probably fair game. However, if the two had engaged in a torrid affair, why kill the golden goose? I added B.W.'s and Jake's names to the list. I kept thinking I'd overlooked something obvious, but I couldn't think what it was. I took a break and made myself a peanut butter and pickle sandwich for my supper. I substituted a paper napkin for a plate and thus reduced the dirty dishes to a bare minimum. I was just in the process of washing my knife when the telephone rang. The woman on the other end of the line said, "This is Anna Erickson. I believe you left a message on my machine." "Are you the Erickson who once lived at 3906 Land's End Road in Serena Station?" There was a cautious silence. "Why do you want to know?" "I'm sorry. I should have explained myself earlier. I'm interested in contacting the family who lived next door to Foley and Violet Sullivan in 1953. That was my parents' house, where I grew up." "Really? Wow, that's great. I'm lucky you didn't get married, or I'd have never tracked you down." "Oh, honey, I'm gay. You couldn't pay me to get married. I got troubles enough." "Do you remember Violet?" "Not directly. I was a little kid back then, but people have been talking about her for years and years. We lived next door to the Sullivans when I was growing up. I suppose you know they found her buried in her car." I said, "So I heard. Look, I know this is a long shot, but is there anything you can tell me about Violet?" "No. I'm sorry to say I don't remember her, but I do remember that 4th of July." "You're kidding. You remember that particular 4th of July?" "I sure do. We'd gone to the fireworks, and afterwards Daisy's friend Tanny spent the night with me. I can't tell you how thrilled I was. I was 5 years old, and she was 9, and I just admired everything about her. She talked me into jumping on the bed in my room, which I wasn't allowed to do. So there we were, bouncing away, having the time of our lives. She bumped me, and I toppled off and broke my arm. The bone didn't heal right, and I got a hump in it to this day. It's one of my first concrete memories." I could feel myself blinking, wondering if the woman had made a fundamental mistake. I was told Tanny went to the fireworks with her dad. "Oh, she did. But we ran into them at the park, and Tanny's father asked Mother if we could keep her overnight. He said he had something to take care of and wasn't sure what time he'd be back." "Did he say where he was going?" "If he did, it didn't register with me. He might have told Mother, but she's long dead. Why not ask Tanny? She might know." "I'll do that. Thanks. I truly appreciate your help." "You're entirely welcome." Chapter 27. Liza. Saturday, July 4th, 1953. Liza Mellencamp often thought about her 14th birthday, which fell on July 3, 1953, the day before Violet Sullivan left Serena Station. Years later, she found it hard to believe so much changed in that 48-hour period. She'd spent the morning of her birthday cleaning her room. Violet was taking her out for lunch, and Liza wanted to be ready in plenty of time. She had never eaten in a real restaurant, and she could hardly contain herself. She and her mother had once shared a tuna sandwich at a drugstore lunch counter, but that wasn't the same. At 9:30, she turned on her Philco clock radio and listened to The Romance of Helen Trent and Our Gal Sunday while she made her bed, emptied the wastebasket, and shoved her dirty clothes into the hamper. Monday, she'd take everything to the laundromat, as she did every week. She'd end up doing most of the household chores, in any event, because her mom was usually too drunk to do much except lie on the couch in the living room, smoking cigarettes and burning holes in the rim of the wood coffee table. She tidied and dusted her desktop, night table, and bookshelves. She shook out the scatter rugs off the porch rail and left them there to air. She wet-mopped the linoleum on her bedroom floor and then went over it with Johnson's Jubilee, liking the glossy, wet shine, though she knew it would dull as it dried. In the bathroom, she scrubbed the tub, toilet, and sink with Babo cleanser. There were too many chips and stains to make a difference, but she felt better knowing it was done. At 11 o'clock, she ironed her best white ship-and-shore blouse with the Peter Pan collar and the baby doll sleeves. She took a shower and got dressed. Violet had called to say she had a big surprise, and when she and Daisy swung by the house at 11:45, she was driving a brand new Chevrolet. She laughed at Liza's wide-eyed response. Liza couldn't remember ever even sitting in a new car, and here she was marveling at the white sidewall tires, dashboard, the interior upholstery, and shiny chrome window cranks. Violet drove into Santa Maria, where the three of them had lunch in the tea room at the Savoy Hotel. Liza and Violet both had shrimp cocktails for a first course, and then this tiny cup of chicken soup and a plate of finger sandwiches, brown bread with cream cheese and chopped nuts, egg salad, ham salad, even one with watercress and thinly sliced radishes. She and Violet ate with their little fingers crooked up, pretending to be oh so la-di-da. Daisy had buttered noodles, which was just about the only thing she'd eat except for Welch's grape jelly on bread. They had layer cake for dessert, and Liza's arrived with a candle in it, which she blew out, blushing with pleasure as the waiters and waitresses stood around and sang to her. Just when she thought life couldn't be any more perfect, Violet handed her a small box wrapped in beautiful lavender paper. Liza opened the gift with trembling fingers. Inside, there was a silver, heart-shaped locket about the size of a 50-cent piece. Inside, there was a tiny photograph of Violet. "And look at this," she said. She pulled the photo aside to reveal a second heart-shaped compartment behind the first. "That's for your true love," Violet said, pointing to the blank space. "I predict within a year you'll know exactly who it is." "Thank you." "Oh, sweetie, don't cry. It's your birthday. This is the best day of my life. You'll have others much better, but enjoy. Here, let's put it on." Liza turned around and lifted her hair while Violet fixed the clasp. Liza put her hand against the locket that was nestled in the hollow of her throat. The silver was already warm from contact with her skin. Her lucky charm. She could hardly quit touching it. Violet paid for lunch out of a thick wad of bills, making sure everybody noticed. She seemed pleased as punch, and more than once remarked that life was soon going to be 100% improved. Liza thought if that were really true, she wouldn't have to repeat it 4 times during the meal, but Violet was like that. "Oh, geez, Louise, I almost forgot," she said. "I need a babysitter tomorrow night. Are you free?" Liza's smile faded. "Not really. Kathy and I are going to the fireworks." Violet looked at her with a momentary consternation, having assumed she'd agree. "Couldn't you skip just this once?" "I don't know. I told her I'd go with her, and I don't want to break a date. Trust me, if you're going out with a girl, it's not a date. It's marking time. Couldn't you get someone else? Oh, for heaven's sake, Lize, at this late date? There's no chance. Besides, Kathy's a sourpuss. I've seen the way she bosses you around. Aren't you ever going to stand up to her? Maybe I could come for a little while. Until 8:45. We could hold off going over to the park till then. Violet fixed Liza in her clear green gaze. If you sat the whole evening, you could have Ty come over. You know I wouldn't care. Missing the fireworks isn't that big a deal. There's always next year. Liza was stricken. What was she supposed to say? The day had been so perfect, all because of Violet, who wanted only this one small thing. Violet's eyes widened. Please, please, please. You can't let Kathy take up all your time. I really need the help. Liza didn't see how she could refuse. She sat for Violet all the time. Violet had been counting on her even if she forgot to ask. And Kathy had been such a pill of late. All right, I guess. Maybe I can do something with her on Sunday instead. Thank you, Sugar Bun. You are too, too sweet. That's okay, Liza said, flushing with pleasure. Praise of any kind always made her warm. After lunch, for the finale, Violet took Liza and Daisy to see a 3D movie called Bwana Devil, with Robert Stack and Barbara Britton. It had been in the theaters for 7 months, but it hadn't come to Santa Maria until recently. The three of them settled in front row seats with their cardboard glasses, wearing wax lips for fun, munching popcorn and milk duds. Violet told her that for the early 3D movies, one lens of the giveaway glasses was green and the other was red. This was new technology, Polaroid, with both lenses clear, though Violet wasn't quite sure how either process worked. Why one green and one red lens would produce a 3D effect was beyond her, she said. The credits began, and they settled in. Unfortunately, the first time a lion jumped straight out of the screen at them, Daisy got hysterical and cried so hard Liza had to take her out to the lobby and sit for an hour. Still, it was the best birthday Liza could remember, and she hated to see the day come to an end. After they got back to the Sullivans, Liza sat with Daisy for an hour while Violet ran an errand. Thankfully, Foley didn't come home until 6 o'clock, so she didn't have to deal with him. True to form, Violet took longer than she said, so it was close to 5:45 by the time Liza finally got to her house. Her mother heard her come in and called her into the living room. Liza stood at the door while her mother struggled into a sitting position. Her mother had that fuzzy look that made Liza want to scream. What? She said. She didn't want to spoil the good mood she was in, but she knew better than to ignore her mom. Word of warning. Kathy Kramer came by with your birthday present, and when she found out you weren't here, she got that look on her face. Her mother's consonants were only slightly soft. In her own curious way, she was aware of what was going on. Liza felt her heart sink. The last thing in the world she wanted was for Kathy to find out she'd had lunch with Violet and had seen Bwana Devil afterward. Kathy had been talking about Bwana Devil for weeks, trying to get her dad to drive them into town and drop them at the theater. Liza didn't feel she was under any obligation to wait and go with her, but she knew Kathy would see it differently. What did you tell her? I forget. I made some excuse for you. She woke me from a sound sleep, standing on the porch, pounding on the front door like the house was burning down. I hollered for her to hold her horses, but by the time I got there, she was already acting like she had a stick up her butt. I told her I didn't have a clue where you were, and she got all snotty and sullen. Honestly, Liza, what do you see in her? She's chained to you like a rock, and she's dragging you down. You didn't mention Violet. Why would I do that? Where'd you put the present? She took it to your room and said she'd leave it on your desk. Liza made a beeline for her room, suddenly worried that Kathy had taken advantage of the opportunity to snoop. Her room was much as she'd left it, but when she went to check her diary, hidden behind the bookcase, She couldn't be sure if it had been moved or not. She sat on the bed and leafed through the pages, waves of anxiety coursing through her. She'd recorded every detail of her romance with Ty Eddings, and if Kathy had read the last few entries, she was doomed. According to Kathy, even the use of junior Tampax was an affront to the notion of absolute purity. Liza found a new hiding place for the diary, and then sat on her bed and opened Kathy's present, which was beautifully wrapped in pink-flowered paper with a pretty pink bow on top. Pink was Kathy's favorite color. Liza herself preferred shades of purple, which was also Violet's favorite. When she saw what Kathy had given her, she could hardly believe her eyes. The box of Lily of the Valley dusting powder was the same one she'd given Kathy for her birthday in March of the year before. She checked the bottom of the box, and, sure enough, there was the same drugstore sticker she'd torn in half when she tried to peel it off. Clearly, Kathy hadn't used the powder and didn't remember who'd given it to her. Now what? Liza didn't want to call her at all. On the other hand, she thought she'd be smart to get it over with. If Kathy had read her diary, she'd never pass up the opportunity to chide and condemn her, superior as always. Liza went to the phone in the hall and dialed Kathy's number. Mrs. Kramer picked up.
"Hi, Mrs. Kramer. This is Liza. Is Kathy home?" "Just a moment."
She put a hand across the mouthpiece, and Liza could hear her holler up to the second floor.
"Kathy! Liza's on the phone!"
There was a long pause while Kathy clumped down the stairs.
"Hope you had a good birthday," Mrs. Kramer remarked while they waited.
"I did, thanks."
"Here she is."
Kathy took the handset and said, "Hello?" in a voice that was dead and remote.
"Hi. I called to say thanks for the bath powder. It's really nice."
"You're welcome."
Even the two words sounded snippy and clipped.
"Is something wrong?"
"Why would you say that?"
"Kathy, if something's bothering you, just tell me."
"Well?"
"Where were you? That's what's bothering me. We had a date."
"We did?"
"Yes. This afternoon. My mother was supposed to take us to the Five and Dime."
Liza could feel the cold envelop her body as Kathy went on in her martyred, accusatory tone.
"We were supposed to pick out a pattern and fabric so we could sew matching skirts and waistcoats for our new fall wardrobe. Don't you remember?"
"I remember you mentioned it, but that was weeks ago, and you never said what day."
"Because it was so obvious. It was for your birthday, Liza. I didn't think I had to spell it out. We drove over to pick you up for lunch, and you were gone. Your mom didn't even know where you were."
"I'm sorry. I forgot."
"How could you forget? We always spend our birthdays together. It's traditional."
"We've done it twice," Liza said.
She knew she'd pay for the sass, but she couldn't help herself.
"Well, I guess it means more to me than to you," Kathy said.
Liza couldn't think of a response, so she said nothing.
"So, where did you go?" Kathy asked.
"No place in particular, just out."
"I know you were out. I'm asking where."
"Why do you care?" Liza couldn't believe she was being so ornery, but she was sick of catering to Kathy's moods.
"I care, Liza, because I want to know what's so important you had to stand me up."
"I didn't stand you up. I forgot, okay?"
"I know you forgot. You already told me that 100 times. You don't have to rub it in."
"Why are you so mad? It was an honest mistake."
"I'm not mad. Why should I be mad? I asked for an explanation. Since you were so rude as to violate our agreement, I think you owe me one."
Liza felt her temper climb, Kathy having neatly maneuvered her into a corner. If she told her where she'd been, Kathy would raise a big stink, or she'd sulk for days, or she'd do both. But in no way would she ever leave the subject alone. Liza had seen it before. Once someone made Kathy mad, she never let him off the hook.
"I was busy." Doing what? Kathy said, exasperated. What difference does it make? In other words, you won't tell. Thanks so much. I'd never do anything that horrible to you. Oh, stop exaggerating. It's not horrible. I thought we were best friends. I didn't say we weren't. But that's not how you treat a best friend, keeping secrets and being mean. I'm not being mean. You know what? That's the difference between us, what you just said. You can't admit the truth. Moral rearmament has made me a better person. But absolute unselfishness doesn't mean a thing to you. It's whatever you want, whatever you feel like doing, and then you lie about it afterward, Liza said. I have to go. My mom's calling me. Kathy's voice had a quaver now. You know what? Absolute honesty? You hurt me. Deeply. All week long I looked forward to seeing you. It was going to be the bright spot of my day. Put yourself in my place and think how I felt when I heard you hadn't even left a note. Kathy, it's not like I did it on purpose. I made a mistake. Then why didn't you call me when you got home? That's what I'm doing. I'm on the phone. I'm calling you. What else could this be? Oh, sure, hours late. I just walked in the door. You were gone all day? Why are you making such a fuss? I'm making a fuss? So now it's my fault? I didn't say it was your fault, but you don't have to make such a big deal of it. You do things without me. Why can't I do one tiny thing without you? Fine. Be that way. I'm sorry I brought it up. Liza could feel herself crumble. This would go on for the rest of her life unless she found a way out. Look, I'm really sorry, okay? I apologize. There was a momentary silence. Kathy didn't like giving up the power position. Do you mean that? I do. Sincerely. I didn't want to say where I was because it had to do with my mom and her, you know, her problem. Oh, you poor thing. Why didn't you say so? I was embarrassed. I hope you'll forgive me. Of course. I completely understand. But really, if you'd confided in me, we could have avoided this misunderstanding. Next time, I will. I'm sorry I wasn't completely honest with you. That's all right. Liza, it's not your fault what she is. I appreciate your being so nice about it. Having capitulated, why not grovel as well? So, what time do you want to go to the park tomorrow night? You think 6 is too early? I made some deviled eggs. I thought we could take a picnic. Liza was at a loss for words. Liza? I'm here. The problem is, I can't go. That's another reason I called. My mom's kind of sick, and I have to stay home because she needs me. But won't she be better tomorrow? I'm not sure. I don't think so. She doesn't look good. You can't even leave her for an hour? I better not. What's wrong with her? I don't know. I'm calling the doctor as soon as I hang up from you. She's been sick all day, so it might be serious. You want me to come keep you company? I don't mind skipping the fireworks. We could make popcorn. We better not. She could be contagious. She's calling me right now, so I gotta go. I'll talk to you tomorrow, okay? Sure. I hope she feels better. Me too. When Liza placed the handset back in the cradle, the small of her back was damp. She played the conversation over and over in her mind, reconstructing Kathy's tone, wishing she'd been quicker on the draw when Kathy tried to shoot her down. She shouldn't have lied about her mom, but what else could she do? She didn't see how Kathy would ever find out. She knew Kathy was full of pity for her because of her mother's drinking, and often told her she prayed for her in church, citing absolute love. Didn't feel like love to Liza, but what did she know? She decided to fix her mother an early supper, since she and Ty were going out that night. She couldn't wait to tell him all the stuff Kathy said.
He didn't like Kathy in the first place, and he'd be tickled to hear she'd finally stood up to her, for as long as she had. You couldn't handle everything at once. She set the water on to boil for the minute rice, and then opened a can of Libby's corn and a can of Libby's green beans. She tried to make sure her mother got a balanced meal, but half the time her mother didn't want to eat, no matter what it was. Liza had fixed Spam 2 nights before, so she took the chunk out of the refrigerator and cut a fresh slice, which she fried in oleo. Once the meal was fully prepared, she arranged everything on a tray, added a paper napkin and utensils, and took it into the living room. Her mother was dead to the world, cigarette still burning in the ashtray. Liza put it out and took the dinner tray back to the kitchen. She set it on the counter where her mother would see it later. Then she washed the pots and pans and put them away. Ty picked her up at 9 o'clock, driving his uncle's truck, which he did whenever he could cadge it. When she got in, he handed her a package with a bow clumsily affixed. "What's this?" she asked, taking out a bottle of what looked like champagne. "Cold duck. I got it at the mini-mart so we could celebrate. Happy birthday."
"You bought alcohol?"
"I look like I'm 21, so I do it all the time. The guy never even carded me."
"You better hope your aunt doesn't find out."
He smiled, flashing white teeth and dimples. "I got something else for you, too, but that's for later." Liza smiled, cheeks burning. She'd never received a present from a boy. Right away, she hoped for an ID bracelet, engraved with both their names, something to commemorate their love. They drove out to the Tanner property as they had on 2 previous occasions. They couldn't very well ride around town. If the two were seen together, he'd be in trouble with his aunt. The new road had been graded but only partially paved. A trench had been dug to form a culvert, and lengths of corrugated pipe had been brought in by crane. Now, as Ty swung off the frontage road, they could see that a temporary road-closed sign had been set up, blocking access. A line of orange cones ran across the road to further discourage traffic, and a no-trespass sign had been posted. Guess they meant business. Since the 4th fell on a Saturday, government offices were closed on Friday, the day before. No court, no mail delivery, no library, and no banks. The county road crew had apparently been given the 3-day weekend as well. Ty drove around the barrier, passing the dirt, mounds, and heavy equipment. A bulldozer seemed to glow in the fading light of day. He'd scoped out the house and grounds in advance of their first visit, and discovered the open shed he now used to conceal his pickup. He helped her out of the passenger side, leading her by the hand as far as the expansive wooden porch that ran along the back of the house. Faintly, in the distance, they could hear the hush of passing cars out on the 101. He said, "Hang on a sec." He went back to the truck and returned moments later with a bundle under one arm. "Sleeping bag," he said. He kept a hand on her back, guiding her as they made their way through the darkened kitchen and up the servants' stairs. The house was stuffy after being closed up for so long. Once they reached the master bedroom at the front of the house, Ty opened all the windows to let the heat out. The breeze coming in across the sill was warm, but at least it created some circulation. He laid out the bulky sleeping bag and stretched out a hand, pulling her down beside him. He opened the bottle of cold duck and offered her the first swig. It tasted better than she expected, and she liked how warm and fuzzy it was making her feel. They passed the bottle back and forth until half of it was gone. She lay on one side, head propped on her hand, while they talked in whispers. She started to tell him about Kathy, but he kept interrupting her with kisses and deep, meaningful looks. He said, "Your present. I almost forgot." He took out a small jar of Vaseline, holding it out to her with a smile.
"What's that for?"
"You know, just in case." Liza felt her stomach knot, and she sat up.
"I don't think we should do this. It's not a good idea."
"Don't worry about it. You don't have to decide anything right now. It's completely up to you," he said. He pulled her down beside him and kissed her again. By now, they'd progressed from the innocent petting of their early dates into more treacherous territory. And Ty took it as a given that each time they were together, they'd pick up where they left off. He was already intent on the business of stripping her down. Liza wasn't entirely willing, but she knew she couldn't refuse. The kissing did feel good, and she was lucky he'd chosen her when any other girl in school would be happy to take her place. She found herself floating in the moment, carried along by his determination and her own inability to resist. In the back of her mind, a tiny voice was whispering that his insistence and Kathy's bullying weren't all that different, but the cold duck had made her feel sleepy and too relaxed to care. Easier to give in than to raise any more objections. It's not like it wasn't nice. He was kissing her bare boob when she saw a flash of headlights swing across the ceiling. Down below, gravel crunched. The vehicle so close to the house they could hear the driver pulling on his brake. Liza gasped and broke free, scrambling to her hands and knees as the car door slammed.
"Oh, my Lord, someone's here."
Ty crawled over to the window and peered out.
"Don't panic. It's fine. He isn't coming this way."
Liza eased in behind him, her eyes just above sill level. The driver was on the far side of the vehicle, which was 10 yards away. She picked up the smell of smoke before she saw the speck of red-hot ember at the end of his cigarette. Liza said,
"Who is that?" "He must be a security guard. Looks like he's checking the equipment." "We gotta get out of here."
She crawled back to the sleeping bag and snatched up her clothing, piling her shoes on top. Ty pulled on his jeans, and they scurried across the room to the walk-in closet, where they shut themselves in. They finished dressing in haste, Liza feeling so anxious she nearly wet her pants. Ty looked over at her, saying, "You okay?
What if he sees the truck? He'll know someone's here."
Ty opened the closet door and peered around the frame. The house was dark, but she could make out his profile. So beautiful. He motioned to her, and the two emerged from their hiding place. Liza listened intently, but picked up no sounds of activity inside the house itself. Ty reached for her hand, and the two eased over to the window and peered out again. Liza could see the swinging beam of a flashlight as the fellow walked across the road, adjusting cones as he went. Ty said,
"Let's move it. I think we can make it to the truck before he turns around and comes back."
They picked their way out of the room and tiptoed along the corridor until they reached the back stairs and started down. Liza nearly fell over Ty, not realizing he'd stopped to listen again. Nothing. Liza held onto his t-shirt as they passed the butler's pantry, and from there traversed the cavernous kitchen, which was bathed in soft gray light. The moon, in its last quarter, was visible through one of the kitchen windows. Outside, they race-walked across the grass to the shed. Ty felt his way down the length of the truck until he could open the driver's side door. Liza climbed in first and crawled across the seat to make room for him. Ty climbed in after her and slid under the wheel. He pulled the door shut without slamming it, careful not to make a sound. They sat then, scarcely daring to breathe. Ty torqued himself around, staring out the rear window at the darkened yard. The width and breadth of the house blocked all view of the front, but there was an illusion of hearing more acutely when one stared at the source. Liza said,
"Do you think we should risk it?"
"Not yet." Liza had a sudden thought and put a hand on his arm.
"We forgot the sleeping bag." "Don't worry about it. We can pick it up next time. But what if he comes across it?"
Ty held a finger to his lips, and they fell silent again. 10 long minutes passed, and then they heard the grumbling of one of the big machines, engine grinding to life, shattering the stillness. When the racket continued, Ty took advantage of the noise to cover the starting of his truck. He backed out of the shed and crept along the service road with his headlights out.
When they cleared the house, they could see a shape as lumbering as a tank, crawling in the opposite direction. Ty continued down the service road, with Liza praying he wouldn't steer them into a tree. Finally, he felt safe enough to turn on his fog lights, which provided sufficient illumination for their agonizingly slow escape. Saturday morning, the 4th, Liza called the Kramer house. She hoped to have a conversation with Kathy in which she could casually mention her mother's illness to reinforce the fib. Telling the same lie more than once made it seem more real. Mrs. Kramer answered and said Kathy really wasn't able to come to the phone. Her voice was chilly, and Liza knew Kathy had blabbed to her about their fight.
"Well, would you tell her I called?"
"Of course." Liza didn't see how Kathy would ever find out she was babysitting for Violet instead of staying at home with her mother, as she'd claimed. Ty had begged her to let him come over to the Sullivans and keep her company, and of course she'd agreed. Early in the afternoon she wandered over to Violet's. Foley was off somewhere, and Liza was hoping she and Violet could have a heart-to-heart talk. Unfortunately, Daisy was in the bedroom, playing with her paper dolls, and it didn't seem advisable, given the subject matter. She'd hung out for a while, and then she'd gone home. She sat on the front porch in an old aluminum lawn chair, hoping Kathy would pass the house and see her there. By 6:15, she was back at the Sullivans, minding Daisy in the bathtub while Violet and the yapping Pomeranian went out the door. She made sure Daisy dried herself and got in her PJs. They sat at the kitchen table and ate vanilla ice cream until 8:15. Daisy was easily confused about telling time, so Liza said it was 9 and marched her off to bed. Liza gave her the pill Violet had left and watched as Daisy swallowed it with half a glass of milk. 20 minutes later, she was safely tucked in bed and limp with sleep. Liza went out the back door and sat down in one of the two lawn chairs that overlooked a scruffy patch of grass. The wooden fence was less than 6 feet tall, but a thick tangle of honeysuckle spilled over the top, obscuring her view of the street. It was hot, and her T-shirt was sticking to her back. She went inside again and sat in the living room, where she turned off the overhead light and let the table fan blow across her face. At 9 o'clock, she heard Ty scratching at the back screen. He stood outside the door, and the gaze he fixed on her was as hungry and as patient as a fox's. She let him in, and he kissed her, pressing himself against her. For once, she had the presence of mind to slip out of his grip.
"Ty, I'm not going to neck with you in here. What if Daisy wakes up or the Sullivans come back?"
"Come on. Foley's at the park, and I saw Violet barreling down the road in that fancy car of hers. Neither one of them are coming back for hours."
"I don't care. I'm not going to do it."
"How about we go out to my pickup? It's parked in the alley out back. I spread some blankets in the bed so we can lay there together and look at the stars."
"Are you crazy? I can't leave Daisy by herself."
"I didn't say we'd go anywhere. It's just someplace private where we can talk without waking her."
"I don't think it's right. I'm supposed to stay in the house."
"Did Violet say that specifically?"
"No, but that's what she pays me to do."
"Half an hour. An hour. No one's ever going to know." He'd wheedled and coaxed, making it all sound easy and insignificant. Finally, she'd given in and followed him through the yard to his pickup. Of course, the minute they were stretched out in the truck bed, he'd started in on her. The night was warm, but Liza found herself shivering. Her fingers were so icy, she had to tuck her hands in her armpits. Ty was solicitous. He'd brought 2 paper cups and another bottle of cold duck. Liza drank more than her share, hoping to quiet her nerves. While they talked, the fireworks display started in Silas. They'd hear thumps, and then sprays of green and blue sparkles would erupt, showers of red like umbrellas raining out of the sky. For 30 minutes, they watched, transfixed. It was like a movie Liza had seen where this man and woman had been kissing and kissing, and the curtains had blown open at the window, and the sky had been alight. After a while, she lost track of time, didn't even care how long they'd been there. She was feeling so close to him. He wrapped his arms around her and murmured against her neck, "How are you doing, Lies? I gotta take good care of you so you won't catch cold." He slid his hand underneath her shirt.
"Oh, don't.
I'm not doing anything." He unbuttoned her shorts and moved his hand down along her belly.
"Maybe we should stop."
"Stop what?"
"We can't keep doing this.
Don't you like it?"
"I do, but I don't want to go too far, okay?"
"Just let me touch you once," he said. He'd managed to get a finger between her legs. She grabbed his hand and held it.
"Wait. I can't do this. I have to go in. What if they get home?"
"They won't. They never come in before the moon closes. You know that about them. They're off drinking and having fun. We're right here, close by. Violet won't care. She likes me."
"I know. But we have to be careful."
"I will. I'll be careful. Here, have one more little sip of wine. I'm just so crazy about you, Liza. Don't you love me, even a little bit? I know you love me." He took the empty cup from her hand and whispered against her hair, kissing her neck and her breasts until she burned. "Be sweet. Please be sweet to me just this one time." She should have pulled away, but she felt suspended, passive, as though she had no control over what would happen next. On he went, telling her he loved her, that it was torture not having her when he loved her so much. By then, he had her shorts off.
"Let me put it in," he whispered. "Just one time, please."
She'd said no at first, but he'd been so excited at the idea and so persistent, she'd relented. What was the harm when she wanted him, too?
"You promise you'll pull out in time?"
"Of course. I swear, I wouldn't do anything to hurt you. I love you. You know I do. Angel, I want you so much it's driving me insane." She felt at the same time powerful and afraid. But he was so beautiful and fearless. No one had ever said such incredible things to her. He seemed so sweet and eager. She had her eyes closed, but she could hear the rustling of his clothes. She made a sound at the shock of his naked body against hers. He was smooth and muscular. His skin was hot, and he smelled of soap. She couldn't remember where the jar of Vaseline came from, but there it was. And he was pressing himself and putting her hand on him and moving against her and wanting her to open up to him. And then she did. She knew he'd already gone too far, but he'd pushed in. Then he was moving and didn't seem to hear her feeble protest. He moved, and he was moving, and then he made a sound like he was lifting something heavy. He groaned, out of breath, and then he slumped over her, relaxed. "Oh, Lies. Oh, jeez. That was fantastic. That was so beautiful." It hadn't even been a minute. She shifted her hips, and he slipped out of her, leaving her goopy and wet. "What's the matter? Are you okay?"
"No, I'm not okay. You said you'd pull out."
"I'm sorry, I meant to, but I couldn't help myself. Baby, it just felt so good. I went crazy for a minute, and the next thing I knew, it just happened." "Shit. What time is it? I gotta go."
"Not yet. It's not hardly midnight. Don't leave me. Here, feel this."
He took her hand and pressed it against him. She'd stayed where she was, half underneath him, warm only in the places where his body covered hers. The rest of her was cold, her limbs pinned to the blanket by the weight of him.
"I have to go in. What if they come home and I'm not there?"
"You can tell him you came out for a breath of air."
"Let go of me, please,"
she whispered. But he kissed her again, murmuring, "You're great. You're amazing. I love you."
"I love you, too," she said. "Ty, I have to go in."
She twisted out of his grasp and groped along the truck bed until she found her underpants. She pulled them on and then searched for her shorts and t-shirt. "Look, I'll see you tomorrow morning, right?"
"Maybe."
"All day. We'll spend the whole day together."
"I can't."
"Yes, you can. Meet me out on Porter Road. I'll borrow my uncle's truck and we'll go for a drive. 8 o'clock.
She could tell her underpants were on wrong side out. She lifted one hip so she could strip them off.
Damn it! Now I got stuff running down the inside of my leg. Give me a handkerchief or something so I can clean myself off.
He handed her his t-shirt, which he'd wadded up and tossed aside. She jammed it between her legs and cleaned herself as well as she could. She eased into her underpants again and hooked herself into her bra. She pulled on her t-shirt and shorts and used her fingers to get the snarls out of her hair. Once dressed, she climbed over the tailgate. Ty said,
8 o'clock tomorrow morning. You're not there. I'm knocking on your door, and I don't care who sees.
She kissed him in haste, told him that she loved him, and then hurried toward the house and let herself in the back door. The screen whined softly. The kitchen light was off, but she could see the luminous hands on the wall clock. 1:15. Violet and Foley usually didn't get home until after 2, so she was fine. Everything was okay. The same table lamp was burning in the darkened living room. The fan rotated at a steady pace, pushing hot air this way and that. Both bedrooms were dark. She paused outside Daisy's room, listening to the child's slow, deep, regular breathing. She was fine. Liza crept into the bathroom. In the glow from the nightlight, she pulled down her shorts and checked her underpants. The crotch was wet with semen, stained with blood. She had to talk to Violet. She knew she should have made him use a rubber, but he promised he'd pull out. And now what? Violet would know. Violet knew everything there was to know about sex. Liza returned to the living room where she lay on the couch, hugging herself. What was done was done. He'd told her he loved her. He'd actually said that to her. And he was the one who brought up the subject of seeing her again, so it wasn't like she was chasing him or anything like that. Still, she wished she hadn't done it. She could feel her eyes burn as the tears spilled out. As soon as Violet came in, the two of them would talk, and she'd be fine.
Chapter 28. I put a call through to Sneaky Pete's. I could hear the strains of the jukebox in the background and a steady hum of voices. This was Saturday night, but it was only 6:45, and the place wasn't going to rock until well after 9. Tanny answered the phone. "Hi, Tanny, this is Kinsey. You have a minute?" "Sure, if you don't mind the interruptions. I'm tending bar, and the gal who's scheduled to work called in sick an hour ago. I'll try to be quick. You heard about Violet?"
"I did. What happened to the poor woman? I know she was killed, but nobody said how."
"I haven't heard a word about the cause of death. I guess we'll know more after the autopsy's done."
"Autopsy? Somebody told me she was just a bunch of bones wrapped up like a mummy, so you couldn't even see her face."
"Well, that's not quite true. As I understand it, she was wrapped in a length of fabric, but it was falling apart." "That's hardly mummy-like," I said.
"Did you get a look at her?"
"Not me. And Daisy didn't either. Detective Nichols gave her the news, but he didn't want anyone getting close to the car."
"How's she taking it?"
"She's okay. I don't think the reality has sunk in."
I thought about calling, but I didn't have the nerve. "Maybe tomorrow. So, what's up with you?"
"I've been putting together a timeline for that 4th of July weekend, trying to figure out where everyone was. You went over to the park with your dad?"
"Didn't we talk about this? I was supposed to go with my brother, but he went off with his friends, so Pop ended up taking me himself."
"Were you there the whole time?"
"I don't remember for a fact, but I can't think why not."
"Here's why I ask. I managed to track down the woman who lived next door to the Sullivans back then, Anna Erickson. Do you remember her? She was 5 at the time."
"Vaguely."
"We just had a chat, and according to her recollection, she and her mother ran into you at the park. She says your dad asked if her mother could look after you because he had something to take care of, so you ended up spending the night at her house."
"Nah, don't think so. It doesn't ring a bell. Are you sure she doesn't have me confused with somebody else?"
"Do you remember bouncing on the bed? She says you bumped into her and she fell and broke her arm."
Tanny let out a startled laugh.
"That was her?
Oh, my God! I remember the little girl, but I'd forgotten her name. Was that the same 4th of July? Shit! She had bones sticking through her skin. It was sickening. You have any idea where your father went that night? Probably the hospital to see Mom. He was there most nights. What's this about? I'm not sure. It's really just a gap I was hoping to fill in. I can ask the next time I talk to him and see what he says. Why don't you hold off, and I can talk to him myself. I'm driving up again Monday, probably early afternoon. You're still working for Daisy? I thought you'd be done. This is what you call mop-up. She paid me in advance, and I owe her a day. After we hung up, I realized I should have downplayed the subject even more than I had. I didn't want Jake to know I was pursuing the point. If Tanny mentioned it and he needed to cover his tracks, he'd have time to fabricate an excuse. Maybe he had left Tanny in Mrs. Erickson's care so he could visit Mary Harrell. The only time we'd talked, he hadn't said anything about that. In fact, he'd spoken in such detail about Foley's behavior at the park that I'd assumed he'd been there. Not to brag, but I myself am really quite skilled at lying, and I can tell you how it's done. Like a magic trick, you distract from the sleight of hand by focusing attention on the irrelevant. I took a moment to call Cheney Phillips, and we chatted for a while. I asked about the conference and then filled him in on my discovery. He offered to meet me at Rosie's so he could buy me a drink, but I was feeling reclusive and thought I'd better level with him. Nothing personal, but all I want to do is sleep in my own bed and not talk to a soul. The past 4 days I haven't had a minute to myself, and it's driving me nuts. Got it. Sounds like you're in the thick of things, which I can understand. Call when you come up for air and we'll have dinner. Perfect. Hey, Kinsey, you be careful with yourself. Whoever this guy is, he's gotten away with murder now for 34 years. He's not going to let you march in and blow it for him. All I'm doing is a record search, and after that my job's done. Trust me, I'm leaving any rough stuff to the sheriff's department. That's their bailiwick. After we hung up, I sat and thought about what he'd said. I knew he was right. I'd already had my tires slashed, and that was before the car was unearthed and the bodies had been found. I unlocked the cabinet where I'd been keeping my handguns. I owned 3. My favorite, a little .32-caliber semi-automatic my Aunt Jen had given me as a kid, had been vaporized in an explosion that was meant to kill me. The next gun I acquired was a .32-caliber Davis that I bought because I liked the looks, thus opening myself to scorn and derision from all the gun nuts who considered it inferior. In deference to them, I bought an H&K P7 and an H&K P13, both serious weapons. The P13 was really more gun than I could comfortably handle, so I put it back in the cabinet with the Davis. I took out the box of Winchester silver tips, loaded the P7, and put it in my shoulder bag. I was now technically prepared, but far from feeling reassured. I was just flat scared. I spent Sunday morning typing up my notes. After lunch, I drove over to the office and sorted through the mail that was piled on the floor. The mailman had stuck so many envelopes through the slot that they'd spread out across the carpet like a welcome mat. I sorted through the bills and then had no choice but to sit down and write checks. I listened to my messages, which were surprisingly few. None required my immediate attention. On the way home, I went by the post office and dropped my paid bills in the box at the curb. I spent the rest of the day cleaning my apartment. Good therapy for those of us who cherish solitude. Scrubbing toilet bowls, you're hardly ever troubled by others eager to pitch in. Monday morning, I put my typewriter and all my notes in the car and drove into downtown Santa Teresa. I parked in the public lot across from the courthouse, put my handgun in the glove compartment, and locked my car. Everything I hoped to accomplish could be done in a 2-block radius, and none of it required me to be armed. My first stop was the title company on the corner. I was looking for information about Santa Maria property transactions in 1953. The original deeds are recorded and sent back to the new property owner, but photocopies are kept in the county recorder's office, quite possibly forever. The easiest way to get to them is to put in a request at the customer service counter at one of the local title companies. I do most of my business with Santa Teresa Title because their library is extensive, and they'll run a simple search without charge. Currently, deeds are indexed according to the property address, but in the 50s, transactions were indexed by name. I asked the clerk for anything they could find for me under the names Jake Ottweiler, Chet Kramer, and or Tom Paget. She asked me to come back in an hour. I crossed the street to the Hall of Records in the Santa Teresa County Courthouse. Since 1964, the estates of Santa Maria residents have been administered in the Santa Maria branch of the probate court, but in 1953, wills were filed at the courthouse here. I'd never thought of wills as hostile instruments, but I was in for a surprise. Cora Paget's will was straightforward. On her death, on March 2, 1959, she'd left everything to Tom, making him a very rich man. The attached Exhibit A indicated that the real property, including a house and four funeral parlors, was valued at close to $2 million. Her personal assets, cash, stocks, bonds, and jewelry, bumped the number up another three-quarters of a mil. I paid the fee for a certified copy of her death certificate, which listed the cause of death as bilateral bronchopneumonia. Nothing iffy about that. I moved to the wills of Calvin and Violet's parents. Roscoe Wilcox died May 16, 1951, leaving a will that was signed and dated December 21, 1949. The will had been filed for probate on May 24, 1951, proved, the assets collected and identified, and the claims of the creditors paid. The terms were simple. Violet's brother, Calvin Wilcox, was appointed executor. There were two specific bequests. The first, the sum of $10,000, which Roscoe left to his church, and a second, which read, "To my daughter, Violet, in appreciation for the love and devotion she evidenced during our lifetime, the generous sum of $1, which is twice what she is worth." All of his tangible personal property and the remainder of his estate he left to my wife, Julia Faraday Wilcox, if she survives me, and if not, to my son, Calvin Edward Wilcox. Julia Wilcox, by the terms of her will, also signed and dated December 21, 1949, left everything to her husband or, in the event that he predeceased her, to her son, Calvin. The remaining provisions of both wills spelled out the attendant clerical details. Inventory valuation, the payment of funeral expenses, debts, federal and California taxes, and any claims made against the estate. Clearly, Violet had been denied any expectation of money, save that one surly dollar, by reason of her indifference, lack of compassion, or abundant bad character. Chet Kramer had implied that Calvin stood to profit by her death, but since both wills predated her disappearance, Calvin was already in line to inherit everything and therefore had nothing to gain by killing her. He might have disliked her, but I couldn't see why he'd risk his life or his freedom to get her out of his hair. Violet was a nuisance, but that was about it. Harold Tanner's will was the eye-popper. He'd apparently drawn up a new one on July 6, 1953, thereby revoking all previous wills and codicils. He named a trust officer at his bank to be executor and established two trusts, one for Steve Ottweiler and one for Tanny. The trusts were to accumulate all income with no distributions whatsoever until the two reached 25 years of age. He further specified that his tangible personal property was to be similarly held in trust until each was 25 years old. I had to go back and read that provision again. Essentially, what he was saying was that Steve wouldn't have access to the money in his trust until 1962, and Tanny wouldn't be eligible for her portion until 1969. The valuation of his personal property, art, silver, and antiques, was estimated at $600,000, but neither grandchild could sell, borrow against, or enjoy ownership for years. What was that about? At first I thought he was being punitive toward his two grandchildren, but then it occurred to me that Jake Ottweiler was the object of his wrath. Old Man Tanner apparently wanted to make sure Jake couldn't collect one red cent of his money, even in support of his own two kids. Given the terms of Tanner's will, Jake would have been forced to dig into his own pockets to cover his children's expenses in addition to his own. Had Harold made Jake the executor or a trustee, he might have at least petitioned for reasonable sums of money related to their health, welfare, and education. So how had Jake come up with his share of the purchase price of the Blue Moon? While I was at the courthouse, I asked about DBAs, those being a record of applications for fictitious business names, hoping to pick up a tidbit or two about how they'd taken ownership. Unfortunately, an application expires 5 years from the date it's filed, and those files are purged after 10 years. 1953 had long been relegated to the shredder. I tried the tax assessor's office across the street, again hoping for information related to the Blue Moon, but the clerk told me the basement of the courthouse had flooded and any records prior to 1962 were lost. Some guys have all the luck. Here I was trying to pry into Jake's business, and I was having no success. I left the courthouse and returned to the title company, where I picked up a manila envelope full of photos.